Season 9 of Beyond the Plate is brought to you by our friends at Ford's Gin. Ford's Gin, shake up the journey. Hey everyone, it's Cappy. Wanted to give you a quick heads up that the episode you're about to hear was recorded live at Graduate Palo Alto Hotel. Big thanks to the Graduate team and to Chef Stuart Brioza and Nicole Krasinski. If anybody has heard an episode of Beyond the Plate, you know we do a fun audio test with our guests. We like to usually have them name five of something. There's two of you. We're going to have you name three of something. So, Nicole, name three ingredients Stuart loves to use in his cooking.
Oh, it's so easy.
Too easy.
Cilantro.
Right. Wait, no. Isn't it cilantro, cumin, and jalapeno?
No, sesame.
Oh, sesame. Yes, sesame.
Stuart, name three ingredients Nicole loves to use in her cooking.
Oh, it's so easy. Let's see. Let's find the far-reaching ones. Black cardamom seed, long pepper, and burnt cinnamon.
I like it. Hey everyone, I'm Cappy and you're listening to Beyond the Plate, the duo season. I'm a chef by trade and hospitality professional. By day, I head up Rachel Ray's culinary operations and co-founded her cooking and kids charity called Yummo. 6 years ago, I had the idea to put together a podcast where we sit down with the world's culinary elite to explore their journey into the food industry and the social impact they have made in their communities. Hence, the name Beyond the Plate. If you're new to the pod, welcome. If you've listened before, we're so glad you're back. This season, we're featuring some of the greatest restaurant and hospitality duos in the industry, and we're grateful to our partners who make this podcast a reality. One more thing, we have some awesome Beyond the Plate merch. You can find a link in your podcast player or go to our website, beyondtheplatepodcast.com. Head on over and check out our hats, tees, hoodies, and more. Again, that's beyondtheplatepodcast.com. Enjoy this week's episode. This evening, our esteemed guests are the husband, wife, chef, owners of Statebird Provisions, The Progress, and the Anchovy Bar in San Francisco, and the co-authors of Statebird Provisions, a cookbook. In early 2012, after a few years of travel, exploration, and starting a family, they opened the award-winning Statebird Provisions, which has introduced a new way of thinking about dining and service. A new way of thinking about dining and service. In 2014, they opened The Progress, and in September 2020, quite an interesting time to open a new restaurant, they opened the Anchovy Bar, which draws inspiration from European wine bars. This power couple consistently supports and respects the foundation of their businesses, the staff and their purveyors. It's fair to say they focus on what keeps a restaurant going and growing. Please enjoy this episode as we go beyond the plate with chefs Nicole Krasinski and Stuart Brioza. Thanks for being here, chefs.
Thank you. Excited.
I want to start with an icebreaker. Just say the first thing that comes to mind. Stuart, name the last great bite you had of one of Nicole's dishes.
The current ice cream sandwich set with the roasted strawberries that are slow cooked for about 3 hours.
Ooh. Nicole, name the last great bite you had of one of Stuart's dishes.
Anchovy season started on Tuesday, and so I had the anchovies in Purgatory. So local anchovies at the Anchovy Bar.
Nicole, you said our skill sets allow us the ability to divide and conquer and know that we always have one another's back. Tell us one thing you depend on Stuart for, in or out of the kitchen. Could be at home.
His visionary ability to see far into the future, know exactly where he wants to go.
That's fantastic. Stuart, one thing you depend on Nicole for?
The many things. The one thing I depend on Nicole for is to always make sure that our son is properly fed.
That's important. I love it. I love it. I like where this is headed, everybody. All right, let's start with growing up. Sometimes someone's past helps shape their future, right? So you both grew up down the road-ish from here and definitely made your way around the country. Stuart, tell us what the Brioza house was like growing up.
Well, I grew up in Cupertino. So at the time, my mom loved to cook. She was an avid cook. She had a handful of dishes that were in the repertoire, let's say.
Did you help her?
Only, you know, when popcorn corn was involved. I did. Yeah, I think that my first role in the kitchen was sort of taking over the popcorn chef title. Many different iterations, you know, the funny one where you melt things in the top as the popcorn kind of like pops and you put your butter in the top. And of course, I would put like chocolate and sugary things and such and just ruin the popcorn maker. But, you know, it was my claim.
Do you have family dinners and things like that?
Yeah, we always had a pretty standard, my brother and I and my father and my mom would sit around the dinner table. The one that I remember, like probably it made an appearance on our dining room table about 2 to 3 times a week was the artichoke. And the artichoke was one artichoke. She had a kind of a pot that she steamed the artichoke in. She still has it to this day and would put it on the center of the table on a big dollop of Best Foods mayonnaise. And we would all just kind of, we'd have our plates of food, but we'd all have the artichoke in the center of the table. And we would just like tear leaves off, dip, and then suck the leaves, the meat off the end of the leaf. And then my dad was like the carver, right? We get to the heart and he was like, stop. And he'd pull out and he would carve the artichoke heart and everybody got their quarter. That was it.
I like it.
Yeah.
What was going on in the Krasinski household?
We were eating whole wheat spaghetti and lots of healthy food. Yeah. It was, my mom was a stay-at-home mom and she was very focused on keeping us healthy and took like a class when she first had my sister and I to learn about healthy cooking. And so there was no sugar in the house. It was,
I feel like she was ahead of her time.
She was.
This is like pre-Whole Foods era.
Exactly. Yeah.
Tofu dogs and whole wheat crust pizza and stuff. That was my house. This is crazy. We didn't have Gatorade at home. We had this thing called Recharge.
We just had the frozen orange juice. But the one thing that we did when we, the few times we did get to eat sugary things were during the holidays, she would make the same thing, like cinnamon rolls for Christmas, a cranberry braid for Thanksgiving, and like an Easter ring. And so we would make those every year. And I really love making them because they were sweet. And then once I started learning more about desserts, I was like, these are dry and not that good. So I revamped all those recipes.
Did you help when you were a kid?
I did.
You did? Okay. Interesting. What were you guys like up getting into? Like when you were a kid, were you, what kind of kid were you?
You really want to know? I was entrepreneurial, right? So before cooking, and really cooking is the only thing I've done for a job, I did have a paper route. Delivered the San Jose Mercury News and in the Cupertino Courier. And that was back in the day with the BMX bike and the papers. You got to memorize the houses. But other than that, I think it was like a California suburban kid. Like the garage door would go up in the summer and it would be like, come home. Like we're a bit feral, right? Just out and just really, really a lot of skateboarding, a lot of BMX biking, building little quarter pipes and half pipes and lots of fun. And then just super active, a lot of swimming, soccer in the fall, basketball, baseball.
What did mom or dad do for work?
My mom was a flight attendant and she worked for TWA in the old days. She's very proud of that and was one of the original kind of flight attendants in the 60s and held out. She actually just retired a couple of years ago. And they were bought out by American, so she was an American flight attendant. I often think, it's like you sort of grow up and you take on some of your parents' superpowers, right? And,
hospitality, like, right?
Hospitality, but even funnier, right, is that what goes down the aisleway is a cart. And what did we do when we opened State Bird? We have carts that go down the aisleway, and we're selling food. And so it's kind of like I made that, I was like, oh, my God, it's so true.
What were you doing when you were a kid?
A lot of daydreaming.
Yeah? About what?
Just kind of hanging out in the backyard daydreaming. Yeah, I was very shy. I was painfully shy. And so, but I was baking. So I found out if you brought people cookies,
they love you.
Talk to you.
Yeah.
So it was my like end to the social scenes.
I love it. When did you two meet?
1995 at Danza. Yeah. So I was 19, Stuart was 20.
Tell me about the first time you met.
We were both studying art and photography.
You were too.
Yeah, both of us. Nicole loves to say we met in the dark room.
We did. We had enlargers next to each other.
Craziness. You both have had this really interesting career path. I didn't realize. But you did you first work in a kitchen when you were 15?
Yeah.
What led you to that?
Let's see here. I essentially, also very active, and I was very into skiing and snowboarding, and I applied for two jobs. One was at Any Mountain, which was a kind of a local recreation retailer. And the other was at a little pasta restaurant. And I really wanted the job at Any Mountain, but I got the job washing dishes. So, and honestly, it really immediately captivated me. I loved every moment of going to work, even if it was washing dishes or bussing tables. And I love the conversations that were happening in the kitchen.
Nicole, what were you doing when you were 15? 15 years old.
Just looking really goth. Yeah.
Stuart, was the kitchen like you loved it right away when you started there?
Yeah, I did. I think it was busy. So number one, you didn't really have a chance to think about too much of the job. You know, it was a busy restaurant and it was that perfect like introduction to kind of food and kind of the idea of teach a man to fish, you know, he'll eat for a lifetime kind of experience. And, you know, I would always get a little meal every day and one of the chefs would cook it for me. And one day he just said, you know, I'm done cooking you food. It's your turn. And he would walk me through different dishes on the menu. In hindsight, I realized that it was just so that he could go and take a break, right? Because then I would like, he taught me through the menu and then I could actually start handling the dishes and putting dishes up as they needed to.
Who inspired you to go to culinary school?
That was a couple of years later where I took on a, you know, moved on from this little pasta restaurant, rose through the ranks, and through one of the cooks at this restaurant had introduced me to another restaurant that had opened, and it had a, this was 1990, and the chef had worked in New York and best friends with George Marone from Aqua, which is a famous San Francisco restaurant that went on to open, and I knew nothing of this, and the story's long how I got the job, but I did get the job, and I started in the kitchen, and it was filled with graduates of culinary schools and people who had cut their teeth at like La Folie, Fleur de Lis. Ernie's was another restaurant of its time. And ultimately, I learned later that the principal of my high school, his son was a graduate of the CCA in San Francisco, California Culinary Academy. He really took a liking to me and they really helped notch out a very positive path while I was in high school, where I could actually learn on the job and earn school units and such. It was really cool.
So you go to CIA. What'd you do after CIA? Culinary Institute of America. He's not in the...
So this led me to the CIA, right? After a couple of more years of cooking in kitchens. You know, I just wanted to learn the language of cooking, right? I wanted to decode it. I knew how to saute and cut and really break down different animals. And I'd really had a lot of information in my head, but didn't really have any grounding. And I wanted to sort of ground that. And I wanted to go to the CIA in New York. And then after that, that kind of led me to Chicago and ultimately Nicole as well.
And so you were here at the time. You guys started dating here. You go to Chicago. You go to Chicago after CIA?
I went to do my externship in Chicago. So this was now fast forward. We're like 97, I think. Yeah.
Nicole, tell us how you made your way into the kitchen.
I graduated from De Anza with my associate's in photography and wanted to continue my studies and got accepted to the Art Institute of Chicago. And my big plan was moving far away, experiencing a place that was totally different. And I felt Stuart and I had visited, well, we had flown over Chicago.
It looked really good from the air.
It's really good from there. And my last name is Krasinski, and there's a lot of Polish people in Chicago. And I felt like I was going to find my hardworking soulmates. So I was really pumped to go to this sort of hardcore city and go to the Art Institute. But I was putting myself through school, which is quite expensive. And so I needed a job. And Stuart was like, you bake all the time. Why don't you try working in a bakery for the summer? So I walked into Red Hen.
Red Hen Bakery. I live three blocks from there right now in Chicago. Small world.
Such a small world. It really opened the week.
The day before we moved.
So when you went into Red Hen to bake, did you love it right away?
Well, so what I did was when I walked in, as I said, I'll come and work for free because I had no experience. I was like, this lady's not going to hire me. So I walked up to Nancy, who at the time had graduated from the Art Institute as a painter and then decided to go into baking. And she had her arm like all the way up to her armpit in the sourdough starter. And I was just like, I have to work here. Like, this is so amazing. And so I just kept saying, like, I'll work for free for months. Like, I've saved all this money. I can afford to. And so she said, show up tomorrow at 3 a.m. And in her mind, she's like, this girl is not going to show up. And I showed up at 3 a.m. Wow. And I worked until I think 6 p.m. And then the next day I showed up at 3 a.m. And I just kept working. So 3 weeks later, she hired me.
That's wild. So you're both in Chicago at the time, both now working in the industry. What was like going on in the culinary world in the late 90s, early 2000s?
Let's see. That time was like Chicago, the degustation menu, right? Tasting menus were really hitting Charlie Trotter's. Every restaurant with any type of ambition, it was like your a la carte menu and you had a tasting menu, right? And that was always the case. I remember foie gras was incredibly popular. And this was about the year that Thomas Keller released the French Laundry cookbook. So I remember the torchon foie gras, you know, waxes poetic about it. And it like overnight showed up on every menu. And also at the time was Amazon was just really starting to the book. I mean, they were books, right? There was Amazon books. And I mean, we had like that Internet Explorer, you know, the little globe that moves. And I remember ordering books and it's like, if you like this book, order this. If you like this, order this. And then every week we would essentially get like a delivery of books. And then we'd also every week go out to all the used bookstores in Chicago. And so we would have mountains of books in our apartment. So there was so much being published, so much from Europe and from the States. And, you know, I think what was going on in Chicago at that time was, I just remember a lot of tasting menus. It was a very exciting time to eat. The Green City, is it Green City Market?
Yeah.
Was really starting to kind of amplify. And that was
That's our farmer's market. It's amazing for like a month of the year. Just kidding. A little longer.
You get asparagus. Potatoes.
For like a day. So what happens in the spring of 2000? What do you remember about that time?
I had moved up the ranks in the restaurant that I was in Chicago and, you know, was looking to go to France. And I had already spent some time there, staged, and now I was like, I want to go. I'd socked away $5,000 or $6,000 and was going to go to Europe and go work. Essentially stage, work in kitchens. Obviously, you do this with there's no money exchanged.
Were you going to bake bread in France?
I was going to say baking. I was like a hardcore baker.
She was dedicated to the bakery. I was like, I'm going to go do this for like 3 to 6 months and really just try to soak it up. And at the same time, there was a little restaurant way up in northern Michigan that had a good little name. It was a restaurant called Tapawingo in a town of about 400 people. And the chef who I worked for at the time, John Hogan, he had been a guest chef up there and cooked. And just, I remember him raving about it when he came back from this place. The owner, Pete, he had called and said, I'm looking for somebody. And he just kind of threw it in my lap and said, why don't you go up and just interview and see before you make your final, you know, decision. This could be really good for you. And go and spend a season and see how it works. And so I flew up and it was the middle of winter.
Chicago to Michigan in the middle of winter, fun.
And ironically, it was this weird heat wave. It was like 70 degrees. And so I get off, there's not a patch of snow anywhere. And it's this like miserable green color, right? Because it was like cold before and it was this weird. And I just remember going like, where am I? We hadn't left Chicago. We had bicycles. We hadn't really seen any. We'd just work 6 days a week. Go, go, go. It's a magical flight over Lake Michigan. And you kind of like enter in this just woodsy, gorgeous part of the country. The owner picked me up. My interview was cook a dinner for 6 people. And I just said, I had nothing prepared. I had no idea what I was going to do. I was like, oh, well, you're a reputable restaurant. I'll just cook from your walk-in. Assuming, not realizing that they're so seasonal and there's really not a whole lot up there. But I managed to go through the walk-in and, you know, really put together a menu and cook a menu. And this place was just magic.
Everywhere I like looked into this restaurant, it kept saying the legendary.
Illegendary, yeah.
I'm like, what is this legendary place in a town of 400 in Michigan? Is it on Chef's Table or something? Like, why haven't I seen this? was.
It was. I mean, it was this place where, you know, it was situated right on a little lake, and you take a long, it's a 20-minute road in, comes rolling hills, lots of farms. So you're right in the center of this farming community. And, you know, I really felt a connection immediately to the owner and to his mission, and kind of came back and I said, yeah, screw France. I'm going to go up to Michigan.
Said no one.
Said, you know, this guy. You know, we ended up staying up there for 4 years. And Nicole.
You went to be pastry chef, right?
Begrudgingly. Yeah. I really didn't want to leave Chicago. Gosh. I loved it. I loved baking, and there wasn't really any option for me except to go and work at the restaurant, which I had no interest in. I thought pastry chefs were like weak. I had all these muscles.
You've been working on your bread arm strength. Was this the first kitchen you worked in together?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. And I was 25 years old at the time.
How was that?
Honestly, it was awesome.
Nicole, how was that?
The best part, one of the many great things about Tapawingo is they had an amazing pastry kitchen separate from the other kitchen. So because we did cooking classes, so I had this huge space with a mini deck oven so I could still bake bread. There was a whole temperature controlled room to make chocolate. And I had myself and 3 or 4 cookbooks. And that's how I learned to become a pastry chef, basically.
What books?
Claudia Fleming's, Charlie Trotter's pastry book, which doesn't work, but the pictures are beautiful.
Inspiration.
Sure. Yes. Alice Waters' dessert book. There's another one. It was a guy in New York who had there was like 17 components to each dish. I can't remember his name, but I took a lot of like one component from here, one from there.
That's cool. So you're both doing your thing in Michigan in a town of 400. Follow me? Making a name for themselves. And all of a sudden in 2004, they're both recruited by restaurateur Drew Nieperant to helm the kitchen of Rubicon in San Francisco. Does everyone know who Drew Nieperant is or no? Huge restaurateur, Nobu. He started with Nobu and Robert De Niro, and like a ton of other restaurants, but many of us likely know him from that. How does like this restaurateur extraordinaire in New York that has a restaurant in San Francisco find two people in Michigan?
Yeah, good question. A lot of word of mouth. We had the right votes of confidence. The Food and Wine Best New Chef in 2003 award certainly helped with that.
You got that one in Michigan?
In Michigan, yeah. And that was wild. That was to get that up there.
10 best new chefs in the country.
The night that was it Tina?
Tina Ulocki
came in. There was like middle of winter. I think she was one of 3 tables. They were the only table. Yeah.
A major like snowstorm came in. We had serious weather. And it was a Thursday night. And in the winter, it was a very slow restaurant. In the summer, it was an incredibly busy restaurant. And yeah, she didn't have a choice, right? They were like working on this program, and
they had a choice.
Yeah, I mean, I guess
you were making good food.
We were making good food, yeah, and we all knew who she was, obviously.
Yeah, so you win that award in Michigan, you're in Food and Wine.
Yeah, and we had cooked an event that sort of put us kind of in the mix of titans of the culinary world. It was a great fundraiser post 9/11 that a wonderful friend of ours, Mickey Baxt. He was the maitre d' of a very well-known restaurant in southern Michigan, in Farmington Hills. And he put together this event, and it was Eric Repair, Claudia Fleming, Marcus Samuelson, David Burke, who I'd worked for, and Takashi Yagahashi, who was the chef of Tribute, and Michael Lasconis, who was also, at the time, the pastry chef of Tribute before he went to Le Bernardin. And Nicole and I. And so I cooked the main course for this dinner, and I got to succeed all these unbelievable, the people that you read about, you know.
So people taste your food, they take notice, you come to Rubicon.
And Drew was there at the event.
Drew was at the event, got it. Was the kitchen always going to be a pair for you both?
Yeah, that was the deal. Yeah. You take both of us or we're not coming.
Got it. So you move back home-ish. And your families are ecstatic, I take it?
Or totally.
Like, finally, you're back.
Yes.
What was it like working in a town of 400 in Michigan and now about to run the kitchen at one of the best restaurants in one of the best restaurant cities in the world at the time, not now, still one of the best restaurant cities in the world, but on fire at the time?
That was a real I mean, it was a real exciting kind of moment, right? To come home and not only come back to San Francisco, but to be able to partner with Drew Neoporent and Larry Stone and have their mentorship and to be handed the keys, really. I mean, we got to do almost what we wanted at the restaurant.
Was it nerve-wracking?
Well, it was, and partially because it was in pretty bad. The morale was kind of real down. We called it the Bad News Bears, the team. It was, there was this French guy that would like open chef coat, just like wouldn't take any direction.
We absorbed a team that was a little challenged, I suppose.
Was your co-working dynamic like in tune at this point, or did additional challenges you didn't see coming come your way?
For working together?
Yeah, like working together in Michigan, then going to...
Built a pretty strong foundation, and again, I had my own kitchen. So at Rubicon, the pastry kitchen is upstairs, and the main kitchen was downstairs, so we had like space to run our own teams and our programs. But that's, I would say, we started to do a little bit of collaborating in Michigan, but at Rubicon, it further, like the working on different dishes or components to dishes together.
Got it. How long were you at Rubicon?
5 years. Mm-hmm.
So you leave Rubicon, you take some time to travel. Where do you travel?
Let's see here. We went to South America. That was a big one for us, which was...
We got married.
Just great. Yeah, we did get married. Yeah, yeah. Been together for a long time and didn't. We had a child. So, yeah, I mean, it was a busy, yeah, it was a busy 3 years.
And then you opened State Bird Provisions on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
What a night to open a restaurant.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah, why not? But wait, before that, what was it like telling Drew that you're, or did Rubicon close?
Yeah, it was a collective decision, right? It was, that was actually a really, it actually, we landed the plane just very gently and very consciously, right? Is kind of how I like to look at it. And, you know, it was a, it's never easy, obviously, to close a restaurant. That's, you know, it's, you know, first when you make the announcement, all of a sudden you're very busy, right? Everybody's like, oh, it's that thing that they can't have anymore, right? And so everybody wants it. So it was an incredibly busy couple of months as we neared the end. He, you know, was really great about giving us a lot of autonomy on how to close it, right? So it was an open conversation. So it wasn't like we just showed up or the team showed up. We talked about it. We had a plan.
I reached out to Drew Neoporent, everybody. And he said, ask them if they remember what I said about the restaurant name, State Bird Provisions, oh, yeah. And serving dim sum style. Yeah. What did he say?
Yeah, Drew, he, you know, we asked him to invest. Like, come on, you got to invest. And if he tells you now, he would say it was the biggest mistake in his career, which I love.
To not invest.
That he did not invest, yes. That he did not, yes. But yes, so he was one of many. When we were setting out to do this restaurant, the first it was, wait, what are you going to do? So we're going to do this kind of small plates on trays and carts. Huh? Are you sure that's a good idea? That was the general reaction. What are you going to call it? State Bird Provisions? It's the, you know, what does that mean? Was that, and then where are you doing this? And we're like, right on Fillmore, like this kind of lower Fillmore. And he's like, what's around there? You know, it was really a bit of a ghost town area. And so, yeah, we had three strikes against us.
Well, you're now in your 11th year at State Bird Provisions. Round of applause for that. That's a good long time. Tell us, for those of us who haven't been there, like what makes State Bird Provisions so special? What can we expect when we walk through the doors of this award-winning establishment? Either of you, take it away.
The thing I loved in the very early days of State Bird, when the door would open, it was a quiet street, right? And in the winter, and the goal was, is I just wanted that door to open and a big roar to kind of hit the street and then the door to shut again and it'd be quiet. And that's exactly what we got, which was amazing. So it was this, it's this high energy restaurant. It's small plates. You sit down and you're like, you're on. This is not your experience where you're going to come in and, hey, let us take care of you tonight. It is dining as sport. It is high energy. There's food flying around the dining room. Your table is greeted with food ready for you to take it, just like a dim sum restaurant or, you know, what I think is like hors d'oeuvres or like a little tapas. Everything's sort of on display and it just comes to you and we just hit you over the head with it, right? We go. So at some point, you'll get a glass of wine. At some point, you'll order some food. At some point, you'll figure out who your waiter is actually, because you'll probably see four or five different people.
It's like you're in your home in a way, just like things are happening.
It's wild. And, you know, the music is loud. The kitchen is right in the front, so you actually feel like you're entering through the kitchen. In the early days, we would actually have to bring people through the kitchen because it was so narrow and packed that we would see people like, you know, who are like, I'm ready to leave and I can't get through this wall of people waiting for this coveted seat. So I would make eye contact and grab, hey, come follow me, bring them through the kitchen, exit through the front door. I mean, it was really just, you just felt like, I mean, you know, first you're completely stunned, right, about what's going on. And then, you know, you sort of just, you get on the bus, right? You get on and you go for a ride.
So the next 11 years, let's say, I feel like there's two schools of thought, and I'm curious your reaction here. One, why fix what's not broken versus trying to stay fresh, innovative, and evolve? I guess, what is your strategy or what can we expect?
We have a saying in the kitchens. We have a lot of sayings, and this one is a favorite: good, better, best. So every idea has to start at good, then we make it better, and once it's the best, we stop. So we recognize when something is as good as it's going to be, and then we can move on to the next thing.
Can you give me an example of something? Is this like a dish or like a service tech?
We call it the good, better, best technique, and so we sort of apply it. Like every idea comes to the as a good idea. It's got to be a good idea to start with, right? Whether it's food, and then when we taste, so if it is a dish, right, and we do a lot of this, a dish comes to the, we put it on the plate, get it on the plate. You know, we just did this with a dish at the Progress, a rabbit annellini, like a little filled dumpling with morels and ramps. And we kind of wanted
this. Had it last night. It was fantastic.
Thank you. You had the best version of it. So the first day, and it took a couple of days, you know, like the flavors were there. We broke everything out. We had a ramp kind of water that we used, which I love the flavor of it. But the dish didn't seem like it came together. It didn't eat. It ate as a three different parts, right? It ate as a pasta, as a mushroom, and as ramps, but it didn't come together the way I feel like great food does when you eat it like this. Like a great pasta dish is not broken into three parts. It's every bite matters and every bite leads you into the next bite, right? Again, it was good when we started. The idea was great. It was very good. We made it better. We thought about how do we want to taste this, right? How do we want to eat this particular dish? And then we make it a few more times. And it took, like I said, 2 days. Finally made it and we came together and it was like, this is it. This is best.
And you just thought they threw ingredients in the bowl and we take a picture of it and then eat it.
But I think it's really easy. It was a method of really a training mechanism for our team. As our teams grew and we now have 3 restaurants, we needed to have some fundamental ways of not letting people get stuck. You know, like when a vinyl record just skips.
Someone in this room is going to remember good, better, best and good, implement better, it best. Into your work.
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize when something is hit, it's like, this is perfect, stop. Right? Stop toiling, stop messing around. And young cooks will really mess around and keep messing with it and keep messing with it.
And adding
sometimes
and
that's
adding
okay,
and
but it's a little, it can be a little irritating too, right? And you're like, I just want to go. Let's go. Let's move on to the next dish. So I love that. And that's how State Bird really is. It's like we do perfect things, but we move on. Recognize when it's great.
That's cool. I keep seeing unique service style in everything I read about State Bird, which I'm sure carries over to the Progress in the Anchovy Bar. And back in the intro, if you remember, I repeated a new way of thinking about dining and service. Now, I love food and the food experience, and I'm interested in food, but something about your service feels more and bigger and best here. Has service always been a focal point for your restaurants?
Well, yeah, and we're coming at it from a chef's perspective, right? Yeah. So neither of us ever worked in the front of the house, but we knew that if we put 90% of our effort into our team and 10% into the guests, then our team would have 110% to give to the guests. So we focus a lot of our time management on our team not on the guest. And so we often get people saying, you know, the food is great, which we love to hear, but like the service, everyone just clearly loves working here. That's what you want to hear.
Yeah, so we actually don't focus on the guest experience at all.
10%.
I know that sounds bizarre, but actually it works in your favor. It really does. And that's how we've really managed it. And so that 90% of all of our efforts go right into the staff experience.
How difficult was it for you guys to go from one to two restaurants? You opened The Progress a few years later? Difficult. I saw that look in your eyes. Hard?
Yeah, it was hard. State Bird, when we opened, we had 6 or 7 months of figuring it out. For a while there, every day was like a new day, new opportunity to really take giant steps. And we sort of used that mentality. We felt like we had that mentality when we opened The Progress, right? And I do like to fly by the seat of my pants for most things. And whew, that was a tough one. I guess we underestimated our own sort of popularity and what we had actually achieved with State Bird, right? Because we did have, you know, it was not that crazy busy restaurant for the first 7 months. We built into it, and then we had one day that changed for us, which was some great recognition in the national press. But we had 7 months under our belt, and we had a pretty good idea who we were by then. At The Progress, you know, I think as many restaurants, it takes a couple of years for a good restaurant to become great. You don't start off great, right? You know, the paint is still drying on the walls, so to speak. It takes even a couple of team generations, right? Where you have your opening team and then, you know, you kind of cycle through a number of your team, and those who stick in really build it. They're the culture bearers. And, you know, when you have really solid culture, I think you have an incredible restaurant. And culture does not, it's not something you can buy. It's not something that you can have a good idea, but if no one knows each other and they don't know how each other move, and the food is still like, what are we saying with the food on the plate? So I think Progress was, it was big. It was a big project for us.
How about Anchovy Bar? Like, what's the significance of Anchovy Bar to you? Both.
It was 75% built when the pandemic hit, and so that all came to a screeching halt, but we were like so close to the end, so we had to keep going, and it's right around the corner from the other restaurants. And the great thing about the Anchovy Bar is we had learned so many lessons from building State Bird and then The Progress and then basically rebuilding State Bird that we knew exactly what we wanted to go into the Anchovy Bar, so it kind of opened like with all the right reach-ins and like exactly like the flow we wanted. We didn't have to redesign it in any way, and it's only 1,000 square feet. So you can really, I've been going there a lot lately. And what I love about it is that our team can really create the vibe of the space because it is so small. Like the last time I was there with a friend who had never been, she's like, this is just like a party in here. This is awesome.
Yeah, we learned a lot. And we had a very focused opening on that too. I mean, it's anchovies. And the idea was to eat from low on the food chain. So we had, I feel like we had our mission statement really dialed out by then. We had plenty of time to think about it with the pandemic. And I still like, what I love is Anchovy Bar now is what, almost 3, which seems crazy to think about. And, you know, I think the food is better today than it's ever been. And we just went through like a major menu overhaul. And I love that. And that's where I think like restaurants really sing in that 2 or 3 year period. Yeah.
Let's do one more icebreaker, even though the ice is broken a little bit. Nicole, 3 words you would use to describe Stuart.
Well, I already said visionary. Can I say it again?
Sure.
Okay. Mm. Visionary, empathetic, and... what's my third word? Like balls to the wall.
That's 3 words right there.
Stuart, 3 words you would use to describe Nicole.
She's incredibly fun. She's my sounding board to all the crazy ideas. She's the responsible one in the relationship for sure. And she's also, yeah, God, the voice of reason. Yeah.
So social impact and giving back, as I mentioned, Beyond the Plate, one of the main reasons we started it was to shed a light on these incredibly generous humans in this industry who are constantly looking for ways to cut costs in a healthy way, save a dime, a penny, a quarter, maybe, but yet they get 100 asks a week to donate a dinner for four and come cook at this event for free and come give away 500 portions of this. And, oh, yeah, you have to pay for it. We're not going to cover the cost of that. Amazes me. And they do a plenty of philanthropic work. So all the chefs we speak with have different organizations or causes they work with. So I wanted to give you both a moment to talk about some causes or charities that you work with.
So one that we have worked with for probably about 5 years is Creativity Explored, and they've been around for 40 years in the Mission District of San Francisco, started by an artist and a psychologist, and they support developmentally disabled artists. And they work with right now over 130 artists who have shown in museum galleries, art fairs all over the world, and sold over $2 million in their art. And so as former, maybe current artist, that's like a passion of ours to support this organization. And then we also have purchased much of their art and have it at Stay Bird. So hundreds of people a week get to see this and engage with this organization if they have questions or...
Another one that we really like is local Meals on Wheels chapter in San Francisco. We've been, gosh, with them for 20-some years. We've raised a ton of money with the organization. My team gets super excited to participate in the Vintners Gala. I actually have an auction dinner I'm doing tomorrow night that raised $100,000 as a dinner in someone's home. So, I mean, that's a really exciting one. And I always like to think about, like, we're feeding the people that built our city. You know, it's really, like, contributed heavily to the city. So I think it's a real... That's an important one for us.
Was there a moment like in your career that you like made it a point to give back or support some of these organizations?
You know, I think that when you start out as a chef, it's hard when you think about your role in feeding the greater good, right? Feeding people when you yourself are working many hours a week and you're asked to add in more time, free time. Notoriously, the culinary industry is, you know, we work really hard to add into that. And I think that what has always attracted us to these organizations is the community that it builds, and the chef community for sure. When you get to cook with other chefs producing an amazing event and you're all there for a similar reasons, it's a great kind of community barn raising for chefs. So I think that there's also like socially within the city of San Francisco, it creates tighter bonds with other chefs. I can think of a whole slew of chefs that have become close friends because of the ability to bring us together and do these events.
And then as a business, we decided to sort of take it a step further because we do get asked 5 to 10 times a day, and our staff doesn't actually really know how much we give back in these ways. And so every 3 months, we change the cause that we give to and we let the staff choose. So we send out a Google form and we say, is it environment for this quarter? Is it pets? Is it schools? And then whenever someone has an ask, if they're in that category, we say yes. And so sometimes it's a lot and sometimes it's a little, but it's also great because then we can say like, you know, we're not giving to your cause right now, but in 3 months we might. So yeah, please check back.
I like that. So great. Speed round. Both have heard some of these, I know, but what did you have for dinner last night?
I had full belly farm wheat berries with caramelized shallots and thyme and steamed cabbage. That's what Jasper and I had.
Got it. What did you have?
Well, I had the same thing you had, which was rabbit annolini with morels and ramps.
Name a smell in the kitchen you love.
Ironically, thyme steeping in butter.
I love the smell of onions and garlic cooking. I think that's such a warm way to welcome people into your home.
Yeah. Name a smell in the kitchen you hate.
Toasting cumin.
The grease trap.
What pisses you off in the kitchen?
Moldy fruit.
When mise en place is not like waxy, if that makes sense.
Tell me more.
Lettuce and herbs, any raw ingredient, when you give it a little squeeze, yeah, it should have a little waxy. Right? Meaning that it is like turgid, it is ready to go, it is not limpy, it is not wilted.
I don't even remember what question I was on.
I got you all roused up.
Gosh, where were we?
What makes you happy in the kitchen?
Watching the team, front or back, taste a new dish for the first time.
That's fun. That's a good one. How about you?
I just love seeing the kitchen hum. Honestly, that's just it. Everybody's sort of moving at their pace. Nobody's moving too quickly or slowly. Everybody's just humming and in sync.
Yeah, I like it. Another. So we heard about ingredients we will always see in each other's cooking. Stuart, one ingredient we will never see in Nicole's cooking.
Cumin, cilantro, jalapeno.
Nicole, one ingredient we will never see in Stuart's cooking.
Anything really floral.
Rose geranium.
Yeah.
Got it.
Never.
Awesome. We're going to close out with a couple of questions, but before we do that, I want to leave a minute or two if anyone has any questions for Chef Stuart and Chef Nicole. I'm happy to go on unless anyone... Yes. And I'm going to repeat the question after she says it for... So she said she was intrigued by the effort that they put into their staff, but how do they... What attracts them to that vibe and how do they obtain that, I suppose?
The multifaceted answer. It's a very complex question. But I think that one thing that we've always really focused on is this being the North Star. And providing like the direction, right? We try to have kind of a hands-off management approach, if that makes sense. We don't want to manage people. Nobody really wants to manage people, I don't think. So we want people to be themselves, number one. We hire our team for who they are. We encourage them to dress how they want to at the restaurant within reason. But we don't put a lot of it's minimal guidelines, lots of guidance, if that makes sense. And then I think the other is that we try to keep our environments stimulating. Intellectually, we challenge our team. We give projects. One that's really amazing right now is our entire state bird team. They have projects, and they all signed up for them. And very simple, like Knoll Farms was a project. Nicole Krasinski was a project. Stuart Prioza was a project, right? So, and different people, they have to really put themselves out there. And it's been awesome, right, to get emails from our team and like, here, I've got 5 questions for you about Wolf Ranch quail, right? And we know the story, but we want to know some other details. And then they present those to their teammates. And I think that is such a cool thing to give homework, but it's like the homework that gives you so much in return, right? Because that knowledge empowers our team to be more informed and honestly to be just better at what they do and to take the job as not just a way to earn money, but as you're here now, what are you going to do with it, right? So I think that's in a nutshell. And it's very deep. It goes on and on and on. But those are big ones. Those are some of the most recent finds, too. Everybody know the state bird of California? You do? Okay. It's not condor. Yeah, it's the quail, yeah.
All right, let's close it out. How about give us a pro tip for balancing family as a husband-wife team in an industry that has a reputation for, as you mentioned, many hours, could be grueling.
I would say, really, it's invest early in your team and create that culture that you want out of the team and know your own parameters, right? At some point, you know, there are going to be those days where your chefs are going to surpass you in the kitchen and you can't show them that card, but you want to, again, be the guide. Right? Guide appropriately. And when you guide and you inspire through that, honestly, the work is pretty easy.
They sound like great mentors over here, don't they?
And also, I have to say that sometimes it's not going to be balanced, and that's also okay. Like when we opened State Bird and our son was 1, we were both working so much, and I don't regret any of that time. Like now he's 12, and he's doing great. So all those long hours were just fine for his world.
Yeah, got it for sure. Thank you both for your time. I appreciate it. Stuart was in Japan on a trip cooking a little while ago, and I was bugging him way too much trying to lock this schedule in. And thank you for letting me do that.
I'm so glad that we were able to finalize
appreciate it. Thank you all.
Thanks again to Chefs Nicole Krasinski and Stuart Brioza. Find Nicole on Instagram @HandsThatKnowYou and find Stuart @AtomicStew. and find them both at statebirdsf.com. To learn more about Creativity Explored, go to creativityexplored.org. And to learn more about Meals on Wheels San Francisco, go to mowsf.org. We'll share a link to those websites in the episode notes and at beyondtheplatepodcast.com. Find me and keep up to date with this podcast across all social media at On Cappy's Plate or go to beyondtheplatepodcast.com. Beyond the Plate is on all the socials at BT Plate Podcast. This episode was produced by myself, along with Ian Cohen, Joel Yetton, and Sean Petrosian. Our digital media producer is Sarah McClellan Mee. Our music has been composed by Goldford. Find him at iGoldford. And as always, a special shout out to my wife, Katie. If you do have a moment, we'd love and appreciate it if you could rate or review and subscribe to this podcast on your listening site of choice. Don't forget to join us next Wednesday for an episode of Beyond the Drink, our companion podcast of Beyond the Plate, brought to you by our friends at Ford's Gin. Thank you for listening to Beyond the Plate. I'm Cappy, and remember, there are never too many cooks in the kitchen.